Well, today is the 75th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. The surprise attack on the Pacific Fleet left thousands of Americans dead and led to the declaration of war by President Roosevelt the next day, our official entry into World War II. Roosevelt called December 7th, 1941, the date that will live in infamy. The attack still is held up as one of the darkest days in American history, but out of the attack and the subsequent war in the Pacific came another infamous and dark moment in American history, one that's not talked about as much. And I'm referring to the United States' decision to move Japanese Americans from the West Coast to internment camps for the duration of the war. 109,000 Japanese Americans were removed and transplanted from their homes in fear of aiding the Japanese. They were transported to camps inland in places like Wyoming and even as far east as Arkansas. A new book chronicles that history and showcases amazing War Relocation Authority photography that documented the move. I mean, it really is amazing photography. The book is called Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II, and the authors are Chicagoans Richard Cahan and Michael Williams. The duo have worked together on several projects, and Richard Cahan, a former picture editor at the Chicago Sun-Times, joins me tonight. Rich, good to see you.
Thanks, Justin.
Thanks for being here. This is a tremendous, tremendous book. And you as a photographer and a great photographer, this is more archive than it is your photography, obviously. But talk about what it means to put a book like this together from stuff that is available to the public.
Well, the photography is eye-opening. The book is primarily photographs that were taken by Dorothea Lang, who is one of the great documentary photographers of the 20th century. And Ansel Adams, who I would think most listeners are familiar with, kind of a scenic landscape artist. But Ansel Adams was allowed to go into camps. He was authorized to go into camps, and he made an incredible portfolio of people in the camps and the landscape around it.
It's so interesting. But let's, you know, before we get into the photography, let's talk about the history of this story.
Sure.
You know, after the attack on Pearl Harbor, there were concerns about the Japanese-American community. And when we say Japanese-American community, there wasn't sort of immigration status yet. I mean, this was 1941, so there wasn't a law that was passed till the 50s about whether, you know, so there was still, these were first-generation Japanese that were here, maybe second-generation.
Exactly.
But it wasn't as organized as we know it today.
Right. It wasn't easy to be a Japanese-American during those years. Japanese emigrated to America starting in the late 1800s, and from the very beginning there were immigration laws that were preventing them from owning land, that prevented them from becoming citizens. So all of the first generation Japanese, none of them were citizens. All of their children who were born in America, 70,000 of them, were American citizens, and they were the majority, two-thirds of the people that were picked up, forced from their homes, and sent to detention centers, most of them for the duration, almost 3 years, of the war. So imagine taking U.S. citizens away.
It's, you know, and in the history of it, the first couple months, because it really started in the spring of 1942, but the first couple months after Pearl Harbor,
there was
almost an ease that the federal government was not going to do this. There was a little bit of comfort for the Japanese American community. They felt like, you know, they were sort of, the FBI had kind of said, no, this is not a threat. There was some, it really felt like this wasn't on the table.
Right. Actually, Pearl Harbor started the FBI's first advance, and within 48 hours, they arrested over 1,000 Japanese Americans. None of them were citizens, but
mostly leaders of the community.
They were suspects. So if you taught in Japanese language schools, you would be arrested. If you were a leader of Chamber of Commerce's, you know, they picked off all the leaders, and that really crippled the community. Imagine 1,000 families without a head of household. But the thought was that this is America.
And they did that also for German, for Italian, like everyone who was essentially the
enemy. But a much smaller number.
Right.
The Japanese Americans were, they were suspect because Japan had started the war. There was worries that there was going to be an attack on California. And there was a worry that the Japanese Americans that lived in America were both spies and they would collaborate. There was absolutely no evidence against them.
And the FBI pretty much said that at a certain point they came out. They're like, everything that we're worried about is not actually happening.
Exactly.
Except as time moved on, there was, not unlike we see here in this country now, there was a public move, editorials, newspapers. There started to be a Japanese backlash that became more and more sort of in the mainstream.
Yeah, I think that this book and the incarceration is really about hysteria. And it's a word that I think we have to be aware of even today. There's a lot of hysteria Absolutely. Going on in the country today. And one thing that I learned from the story is that you never make good decisions when you're hysterical. It takes away our rational right. way of thinking, and that's a key takeaway from this.
But even though the FBI and other officials said this really isn't a threat, the hysteria went all the way up to the White House, right. where President right. Roosevelt gave the authority to the military to make the decision on what they wanted
right.
to do.
It was amazing that the case that was built against the Japanese, one of the villains of this book is Earl Warren,
yeah.
who's considered a liberal. He was the head of the Supreme Court in the 1950s, but he was attorney general in California at the time. And I think he was taking advantage of the fact that he could whip up this hysteria. So he made a map of every Japanese resident living in California. And he showed this Senate subcommittee how close they were to airports.
To oil fields.
To oil fields.
Right.
To ports. To radio stations.
Military operations. Right,
it's like
right.
it's like making a map now and saying, look, there are Muslims that live near O'Hare Airport.
Yeah. And they're living there on purpose because they're getting ready for the impending attack.
Exactly.
Right.
And so... when government officials asked him, you know, there's been no reports, there's been no sabotage, there's been no collaboration, he said, exactly. That just shows you how dangerous they are, because they're so dangerous that they've kept this all under wraps.
So then the military got involved, and that's when it started.
Yeah. Another villain I have to say is President Roosevelt. Less than 11 weeks after Pearl Harbor, he basically left the decision of what to do with the Japanese to the Army. The Army was not concerned about the civil rights of Americans. They were asked to be sure that America was safe. So their kind of Army answer was, let's send them all to concentration camps.
And those camps were set up temporary and permanent, but they were set up. They're essentially Central California right. all the way into the Wyoming sort of area. And like I said, in the lead, right. almost all the way east to Arkansas. I mean, the idea was to get them as far away from the Pacific Ocean as possible.
Right. And really to give them land that was – they certainly didn't want to give them valuable land. So they ended up mostly in deserts. And in Arkansas, it was almost a forest. It was the farthest you could get – that's land that was connected to railroads, because they needed the railroads to mm-hmm. ship these people out.
Richard Cahan is the author, co-author of Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II, tremendous photography from the War Relocation Authority. Right. And we'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll get into that, because, you know, the foresight, and I don't know if it was actually intentional or it was an accident, but to put these photographers on the transition or the central evacuation is a bad word. That's what they want right. to call it, evacuation. Right. But right. the forced removal, right?
Exactly.
The forced removal of Japanese Americans was stunning for the content that it has produced. Richard Cahan in studio. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest at the big table tonight, Richard Cahan. He's the co-author of Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II. It really feels this book, which you can get anywhere. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it at bookstores. You can get it at cityfilespress.com. It reads, it's part history lesson. It's part photography, of course, and it's also, I mean, the amount of content that you produce that's new, where you actually reach out to the kids and some of the people who are in this photography, it's amazing. I mean, to hear their stories about what their experiences were like.
Yeah, these photos, we found them about a year ago in the National Archives in College Park, Maryland. They've been around. They've illustrated books, and you know, they've been shown one at a time. But this is the first real comprehensive look at these photos. And I think that you can keep talking about the internment and what happened, but until you see photos, you know, we kind of use photos mm-hmm. as evidence. Mm-hmm. And once you see it, you understand it much better. You understand that these were not these were Americans that wore leather belts and had you know, check shirts and yeah. they were just picked up and you see it all in these photos.
It really is. It grabs your attention when you see a family in front of almost a picket fence California right. home that, you know, as American as you can get. Right. And then juxtaposed to these, I mean, stark images of trains, you know, going to relocation centers in Los Angeles, and and talking essentially about these being concentration camps. History redefines these. They changed the words because of what happened in Eastern Europe.
Right.
But the idea, these were, I mean, they were even called concentration camps to begin with.
Exactly. And that's exactly what they were. They were concentrating a part of America. And I think that's what keeps striking me, that once we start segregating Americans and saying, you register and you don't register, that's when the true character of America starts breaking down. Mm-hmm. It certainly broke down during World War II. And
well, I mean, a lot of this, the book is around some tremendous photographers. We mentioned Ansel Adams and also government photographers from the War Relocation Authority. Talk about the War Relocation Authority's mission here. I mean, the idea to hire photographers to document this transition seems a little head scratching because, you know, in history, in hindsight, you're like, that's almost like a black eye on the American experience.
Right.
But at the time, they went to a lot of lengths to be able to get this documented.
They did. And I guess we should say what the War Relocation Authority was, something that was started in 1942. And it's exactly what it sounds like. Their job was to relocate people from California, Japanese Americans from California to the interior of the country. Relocation is a bad word. It sounds like, you know, you've just gotten a new job and you're relocating.
Yeah.
But it was, they were really, as we said, responsible for the forced removal. I think that they thought that photography was very important because they wanted to show Americans and they wanted to show the world how the whole process was working. By hiring photographers, they could also keep other photographers out. They could say to newspaper photographers and magazine photographers,
we got it covered.
We've got it covered.
Right.
We'll provide you with imagery. And, of course, the imagery that they provided them was only imagery that they wanted to provide. So I think that the story also harkens back or really talks about the importance of a free press. And as soon as government officials say, oh, there's no need for the press to follow me or there's no need for, you know, the press to cover that, we'll provide the information, I think people should get really suspect.
Yeah, right. There's some written Dorothea Lange,
yeah.
You know, and telling her story as one of the photographers. You know, she had moments in even telling the story or retelling the story of, you know, having being sick to her stomach or having anxiety off of what was happening to these people. It almost feels like the War Relocation Authority got more than they bargained for by hiring this woman to be the photographer because she did such a tremendous job humanizing these people.
They had no idea what they were getting. People should know Dorothea Lange because she took the very famous picture of the migrant mother
and she
documented the Okies moving to California, and she's really well known as a Farm Security Administration photographer. So she had worked for the government in the 30s, and it seems like there's no direct evidence that she was the one that convinced the government that it was important to document this. As you said, I don't think they had any idea what they were getting into. But for Dorothea Lange, she did become ill. She developed ulcers during this process, and she only really worked for 3 or 4 months documenting Japanese American. But the record she left behind is extraordinary.
Well, you could tell because the way she would do some of the photography is she would go and get the sort of starting point. She'd get the families at their homes that were left behind in California that people never came back to.
Exactly.
And then
to come back to.
They had nothing to come back to.
They were given basically a week to get rid of all their belongings, to sell their house, to sell their cars, and just to take what they could carry. And Dorothea Lange had the insight to photograph these people in their homes and standing in front of their homes and playing the game of Go on the last day that they were going to be picked up and their bags and packages are all put around the room. She's known as one of the great documentarians of the 20th century, but when we went through the photographs, we could see what she took every day, and we were astounded. We did a book on Vivian Meyer, who's a great photographer. Dorothea Lange was, she was at a class by herself.
Yeah.
She could do this.
And, I mean, beyond her work and others as well, I mean, because there were a lot of government photographers that were involved. But some of the heartbreaking stuff that you see, like when you see all the packages kind of like just thrown
mountains.
Or everybody's stuffed, mountains of bags,
you
know, with numbers on. I mean, it really does. It conjures up imagery that is so negative in the way that we know from Eastern European concentration camps and the Holocaust. It's just that it's a malaise over this when you see this photography and you realize this happened in this country.
Yeah, just imagine that if somebody said, you've got a week to pack up and didn't tell them how where they were going. They had no idea when they reported. They had no idea how long they would be gone. They didn't know if it was going to be a week. They didn't know if it was going to be the rest of the war. They didn't know it was going to be forever. So the angst that came back. We started the book with this remarkable quote by one of the survivors, who's now the poet laureate of Oregon, Lawson Inada, and he wrote, I love this quote, "Only what we could carry was the rule, so we carried strength, dignity, and soul." And I think that's really what this book is all about, how they responded.
Co-author Richard Cahan in studio, Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II, great book with interviews as well as photography and the story of the Japanese American internment camps during World War II. We'll take a quick break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back, and I want to talk about tracking some of these people down, the process of finding these people and what they had to say about their memories and their history in this sordid time. Richard Cahan in studio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN Radio. My guest at the big table tonight, Richard Cahan. He's the co-author of Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II. We're talking about the internment camps that the U.S. government put Japanese Americans in after the declaration of war. A couple months after the declaration of war, what happened in Pearl Harbor? It's the 75th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor today. You know, it's such an interesting book because the photography really is the lead. I mean, you're seeing some of these tremendous iconic photographers be able to use their artistry to really document this moment in time. But it's also, you guys add to it, and you add to it by focusing on and identifying some of the people that some of the kids and people who are younger who may still be alive and tracking them down.
Right, right. We have about 170 pictures in the book. They span the gamut from, as you mentioned, life in the Japanese-American community before all this happened, to the days that they were picked up, to the early days in the assembly centers, the temporary camps, and then the permanent camps, and then coming home again. We picked the pictures because of kind of artistic reasons and historical reasons, but then we decided that we were going to try to find out the story behind every picture.
Hmm.
Most of the pictures are crowd scenes, so we didn't. But there's about 30 pictures that we wanted to find out who these people were.
They're like families of five, things like that.
Families of five, or sometimes it's an individual portrait. And there wasn't a lot to go on. This was a fluid situation. People were moving fast, and captions that the original photographers left are very spare. But we had lots of ammunition, and we figured out 25 of those 30 people.
Wow.
One way we figured them out is, and this sounds strange, they were wearing tags on the day they were taken away, and they had numbers. And we had a list of those numbers. So as soon as we saw a number, we knew what family they were in. And once we found the family, it was a matter of really...
So you would just sort of go against the database that you found?
So somebody was wearing a certain number, and we could figure out what family they were in, and then it was a matter of really just tracking down the family and looking through obituaries and look through... Sometimes it was people that were on the scene.
When you reached out, and the stories are in the book, but, I mean, were they excited, hesitant? I mean, what were the emotions that you encountered in trying to talk to them about this experience?
People say that Japanese Americans, like people who lived through the Holocaust in Europe, were very hesitant to talk about their stories when they came back. Remember, all these people are at least 75 years old, because it was 75 years ago. Basically, the people I talked to were between 75 and 95. And everybody that we talked to felt a responsibility to share their story and to tell their story. That said, this wasn't without challenge. When I figured out the phone numbers of these people, I would call them. And like most 75-year-olds or 80-year-olds old, the first thing they did was hang up the phone before I could say, "My name is Rich Cahan, a journalist," thinking it was
a telemarketer.
So the process was almost always the same. I would have to wait to a strange hour, and then I would leave a message on their phone machine, and then I'd wait a couple days and call them back. And when I called them back to the person, they were very happy to tell their story. Sometimes they had no idea that they were photographed. Remember, these photographs were taken 75 years ago. Sometimes they remembered the day when Dorothea Lange showed up at their family farm. One woman told me that she this picture wasn't in front of her, but she remembers that her father was very upset because they couldn't find the shoes of her one-year-old sister, and the father didn't want the family to look like hicks from a farm. And I take a careful look at the picture, and there's this little one-year-old in her arms, and she has no shoes. So sometimes they remembered to the day when it was taken. Other times, they had absolutely no idea that they were ever
from. Now, one of the storylines that you – it's in the book, and it's also just in history, is that when the internment camps – when it was up,
right.
when they said, okay, you know, the war is over, right. you can go back – there wasn't a lot to go back to,
yeah.
And a lot of Japanese Americans just chose not. They just didn't go back to their homes. They didn't go back to their businesses. They decided to go elsewhere.
Right. California for many people was a scary place. They remembered the weeks before the trains came to them. I talked about the hysteria. There was real hatred. One of the lessons that I learned from this book is that we Americans, I'm sure it's every country, have a problem figuring out who our actual enemy is. You know, the enemy of World War II was the governments and the people of Germany and the people of Japan and the people of the Axis nations. They weren't the Germans and the Italians and the Japanese Americans that lived in this country. So I think it's really important to understand that people who come from countries aren't the enemies. It's the countries themselves. Mm-hmm. So people... were reticent about going back. They lost their farms. They lost their livelihood. So as it so happens, Chicago became a center for a lot of people. Chicago had about 200 or 300 Japanese Americans when the war started, and by 1948 and 49, they had 20,000.
Wow.
So Chicago plays an important part of the story.
It's a story that, and you kind of just mentioned it, you know, about separating the people from the government or from the country. And it's a story that we've heard more about in the last month and a half, right. when we talk about a possible Muslim registry, which gets scrolled across CNN. But this concept of even the Syrian refugee crisis, where people are coming in and there wants to be some check on who these people are, and this sort of hidden terrorism idea. You know, as you work on this project and you finish this project, those lessons, you know, that the lessons around hysteria or what you learned about what happened in 1941 to 1946, I mean, it's different, but it's the same.
Yeah, this book, we didn't realize how relevant the book was going to be when we worked on it last year, but this book has become very relevant to people. There is actual talk about... registries of Muslims, and talk about how the internment camp is a precedent for this. Well, it's the opposite of a precedent. It's a road we took. It's pretty clear from the pictures and from all the evidence that it was the wrong road. And that's why we called the book Un-American. Mm-hmm. There are people to this day who argue that the security of the country trumps...
wartime is wartime.
Wartime is wartime. But what we did during this time was un-American.
You hear today, I heard in the newscast, one of Judy's newscasts earlier, just this concept. I heard someone, a veteran, talking about there was no formal apology from Japan,
right.
for the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Has the U.S. government ever stepped up and issued any formal apology to the Japanese-American community?
They did. During the Reagan and Ford administrations, there was a formal apology, and every Japanese-American who lived through it received a $20,000 reparation payment. And I asked everyone what they did with the payment. Usually it was to pay for their kids' college education, but sometimes it was to go to a scholarship fund for other, you know, other Japanese-Americans or other – actually, it wasn't Japanese-Americans. It was – refugees who'd come to this country, and these people thought it was very important. Apologies are important, but just as important are the lessons that come from this.
You know, as you think about, and one of the things I took from the book was just the way the hysteria led to the haste of this sort of happening, meaning this became really like a war time exercise,
right.
in the way that they were able to really make these relocations happen.
Right.
You know, it makes you think about, well, there's part of me when I'm reading, I'm like, there's no way that this could happen this way. But there was something about the way that the military ran the operation that makes you think that this country could do it again like that.
That's a really good question. one thing I'll say is, you remember what happened the day after 9/11? We as people had a whole different worldview after 9/11. Things happen. Hysteria happens when we're worried about security. There's something about human beings and Americans. I'm sure all human beings who operate irrationally when they're scared.
Yeah. Co-author Richard Cahan, the former picture editor at the Chicago Sun-Times, his book is Un-American: The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II. Features images from photographers Dorothea Lange, Ansel Adams, other government photographers. And the one thing I didn't ask, and I thought it was great with the sort of statement at the top of the book, is in this day and age with the ability to edit photos and programs and do all the things that you could do to photos, you made the conscious decision to present these as is with the edges and the way that they were. You didn't crop. You didn't change the environment of the picture. You sort of were, you know, you wanted to almost... you wanted to give it as it was.
Yeah, frame to frame. And by showing it frame to frame, we learned an awful lot, including little marks that photographers left that helped us find people. So.
You can find the book on Amazon, other places that sell books, cityfilespress.com. Richard,
thanks. And bookstores.
And bookstores. What are those? We're going to do a segment on those at some point. Great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for the book. Thank you.